the Philosopher's Zone, and class is in.
We've studied quite a bit of political philosophy this semester, and recently we've had a Prime Minister removed from office by his own party. Now, what I'd like to know is, can such a power play decline into a state of nature?
Can't answer that one straight away, but I do know someone who might have a go.
Philosophy, for me, is very, very different to most of my other subjects. I find that with lots of other subjects that you'll do equations or language exercises again and again, philosophy has a far more sophisticated approach. That separates philosophy from many other subjects.
Aristotle thought the young were too young to wrestle with reason. He considered the passions of youth to be too strong. Well, he was wrong about other things too. The Philosophy for Children movement is gaining support worldwide, including here in Australia, coming along nicely since it came to our shores in the 1980s. Regular contributor to The Zone, Dr. Laura D'Olimpio, is very much involved with the movement in Australia. She's co-editor of the Journal of Philosophy in Schools, and today she brings us a midterm report card on P4C, as it's known, with one eye firmly on her home state of WA. Along the way, you'll hear from teacher Dr. Raymond Driehouse, with students Isabel and Braden from Perth Modern School, and from Stefan Millett, who devised the WA secondary course.
P4C started at Montclair State University in the 1970s in America, where Matthew Lipman and Anne Sharp decided that a pragmatic approach to doing philosophy was needed. Their vision was to train children to think critically, creatively, and collaboratively in order to shape democratic citizens. Influenced by the pragmatism of the philosopher John Dewey, Lipman and Sharp coined the term community of inquiry to describe the pedagogy that is central to conducting philosophical dialogue with children. The community of inquiry sees participants seated in an inward-facing circle, allowing them to discuss philosophical concepts and ask questions of one another. The role of the teacher is radicalised as the teacher becomes a facilitator of the community of inquiry, rather than the one source of all knowledge. Almost all of the states now have P4C offered in some way in certain primary and high schools across Australia. Queensland was the first state to offer philosophy as a non-compulsory secondary school subject. Victoria followed in 2001, South Australia came next in 2003, Tasmania followed in 2006, and Western Australia introduced the Philosophy and Ethics course for Year 11 and 12s in 2008. So let us begin with the obvious question. Can young people do philosophy?
We've studied quite a bit of political philosophy this semester, and recently we've had a Prime Minister removed from office by his own party. Now, what I'd like to know is, can such a power play decline into a state of nature?
With the definition of state of nature being, from a Hobbesian point of view, it's brutish and there's no power overarching, therefore everyone has to look after themselves individually and watch their back from every other person should they decide that something that another person has they want, there's no rules to prevent them from doing such a thing. I would have to say that this power play is not going to dissolve our society into a state of nature, because the processes that were used followed the social contract and involved all the individuals that could be involved so that everyone understood and the processes were done in a just and fair way so that everyone knew that it was to represent the people and to continue the society in a forward motion rather than to go backwards or to dissolve society and upset people. What do you think, Braden?
Yeah, I agree. I believe that the presence of a just system, as you've stated, does prevent us dissolving into a state of nature, but we should still be careful of having such power play at the higher levels, particularly when we take the same Hobbesian definition of a state of nature as the state where life is short, brutish and nasty. We begin to see how this is the state which we want to avoid above all else, and this is actually where we get our social contracts from. When the sovereign power stops representing the people, what we end up with is these social contracts have the risk of breaking down. They don't necessarily break down, but there will always be this risk if the sovereign power is not fairly representing the people. Conflict arises, which could lead to something like a civil war, and then we will find ourselves with a significant risk of a state of nature. So we do still need to be careful with such power play at these higher levels.
But Braden, you would have to at least remember that the danger of declining into a state of nature occurs if division begins in Parliament. and that might encourage the people to rebel, not the other way around.
I agree. I do believe that there needs to be a very obvious division within the actual parliament itself. And while this situation here with the replacement of the Prime Minister, I don't feel this is going to be significant enough to cause such division and such conflict, but we still need to be careful with experimenting with such power play, and I think we should approach such power play with caution in the future.
The ancient Greek philosopher Aristotle writes in his Nicomachean Ethics that the young, and not necessarily the young in age, are not suitable students of ethics and politics, both because they lack experience and because they tend to follow feelings rather than reason. Does Aristotle have a point?
To some extent, Laura, I think Aristotle does have a point. Maybe you could say that young people may not necessarily have the experience, but they certainly have the capacity to reason. And I think the study of philosophy, it helps them develop a focus that puts reason more at the forefront. I think young people have the same kind of moral sentiments and natural human values as adults. It's just that perhaps as adults, the defining difference is moral experience, which they will gain over time. But I also would like to think that if they studied philosophy as they experience this moral experience, they are better placed to interpret and understand what that experience means in terms of moral decision-making.
Does this mean that the philosophical conversations they have aren't of a higher level as, say, academic philosophers, maybe?
I'd say that's probably true. When, for example, even with Braden and Isabel, just as an example, when they started studying philosophy with me in year 10, there's a noticeable difference between what they could do in year 10 and what they're doing now. I think over a period of 3 years, their positions and their answers are far more supported, far more precise, far more systematic, and they're more inclined to explore different points of view, as each of them has pointed out. Part of what happens in the classroom is not just critical thinking, it's also, if you like, character formation with the kinds of questions and ideas that we explore.
Isabel, I was wondering, when you're studying philosophy, do you feel as though you have to get the right answer?
I would have to say that no, I don't have to get the right answer, because the ideas that we explore in philosophy are often so abstract or have so many different ways of viewing them that you can't get one answer from it. You can ask a lot of moral questions such as, do you save the group or do you save your family member? And you can do virtue ethics and you can say, get the bigger group or get your family. Either way, it really depends on which philosophical view you decide to go for. So I would have to say that no, for philosophy, I don't have to get the right answer because I'm exploring the answers that are possible rather than getting an answer.
You can never know what's going to be the result of the teaching. All I can hope for as a teacher is to trigger something that is in a student and get them to work on it.
On the Philosopher's Zone today, Laura D'Olimpio on philosophy in schools. Stephen Millett devised the secondary philosophy and ethics course for WA.
So what are the skills we're talking about that we think students will gain from studying the philosophy and ethics course?
The first one's a bulldust detector. To be able to spot bad arguments and to have the necessary tools to demonstrate the wrongness of them so that you don't get the wool pulled over your eyes. But also, because it's a collaborative philosophical course, the collaboration and the working with others is a skill in its own right, or a tool in its own right, that they learn here. And they learn to play the ball and not play the man, much more so than they do in other places. They also learn that working together, they can come to decisions that they can agree with or disagree with, and then accept the judgment of their peers, but not be driven by them. But also to be able to be reasonable, to listen to what somebody is saying and then to try to work out what they're meaning. So we're looking at laying out the nature of an issue or the nature of a problem and understanding the connectedness of the parts. But the richness of the community is leading to a more caring community within the classroom, they're better people. They get on, they fight less, they are more collaborative outside of the classroom. The evidence is quite clear on that.
Can you give us one example of a topic that you really enjoyed that's included in the philosophy and ethics course, for example?
One of my favourites is for a course for students who aren't necessarily going on to university. This one had to do with persons. Wendy was a single mum, had a baby who died. She was 15. And then Wendy got another baby, Louis, and taught Louis everything that she knew, taught him language, taught him how to communicate. And then we introduced the students to the question of what a person is and why should we value persons over other, say, animals. And they got into it. So, of course, Wendy's a person. And then we told them that this was actually a true story. It's a true story of Washo and Luli, the chimpanzees. And so it challenged their assumptions and it challenged their understanding of what is morally considerable. And they did it together. And it was that sort of shock that they go, oh, I've made a big assumption here.
Is there anything the course misses out, do you think? For example, Eastern or Arabic philosophy?
It's possible to do it, but we don't do it partly because we have our own inherent biases. The Western philosophical tradition is strong and rich, and it's hard enough to deal with that well. Dealing well and fairly with an Oriental or a Middle Eastern philosophical tradition is really hard. I personally have been struggling with that for 20 or 30 years.
Given that women in academic philosophy are underrepresented, with women making up only approximately 25% of employed philosophers, do you think we should emphasise more the works of female philosophers in a high school philosophy course?
I think it's important to challenge an assumption that philosophy is done by dead men with beards or something like that, or dead white men of various sorts. It really is important to challenge that. So there's some important contemporary women philosophers who really do need to be introduced to students. Yes, I think that we should do that.
My final question, do you think that children and young adults can do philosophy in the same way that academic philosophers are doing philosophy?
Yes. Children can do philosophy. What they can't do is do it at the same level as an academic philosopher or an adult can do. But they're using similar tools. They need to use age-appropriate tools. And this is something that we're still lacking in philosophical teaching. We lack a scope and sequence of concepts that need to be taught and when they need to be taught it. Now, take mathematics, for example. Students start with addition and subtraction before they move to multiplication and division. So you're just teaching those things. You need to teach these things in order to teach the next step. We need a similar scope and sequence for philosophy teaching. For example, we need to make distinctions. And making distinctions between this because it is not that is a primary start. Young children can start by making distinctions and then move on to things like categorising. They can then, at a certain level of cognitive maturity, because it is dependent on that, they can start to learn if-then arguments and they can learn abstract and deal with abstracts beyond a certain age. Now, let's look at the distinction between discovery and invention. Now, any student who's done, say, Year 7, Year 8, and done Harry Stotlemyre's Discovery, one of Matthew Lipman's primary texts, any student who's done that would be able to understand the recent High Court judgment on whether genes can be patented, because that hinged on the question of whether it was a discovery or an invention. Primary. So you can get that concept nailed down well for 11, 12, 13-year-olds. But what we need to do is help them scope these things and stage their introduction to complex ideas in a similar way to what we do with mathematics. Teaching philosophy 1 hour a week for 6 months led to statistically significant improvements in cognitive ability, IQ. And it also demonstrated that there were gains in science and mathematics, quite independent of any changes that were done in those subjects. So just teaching philosophy if you teach philosophy, children's ability to understand improves and their ability to achieve better scores in science, mathematics and English improves across the spectrum, and that gain is maintained for years afterwards, even if they do no more philosophy.
Isabel, I was wondering, do you think this state of nature is a real concern? When we have this picture of human nature without these civilising influences, Hobbes thinks we're going to be quite competitive with each other, particularly if there's a lack of resources. Another theorist, John Locke, actually thinks that we would be all equal and harmonious and sort of have this idea that there might be peace unless someone were to break that peace. Do you think that human nature might actually be cooperative, essentially?
I suspect there's a bit of both involved in a state of nature where you have to understand that might would probably end up being right in the way of Hobbesian sort of belief, but at the same time, so long as there were enough resources and everyone had what they needed and had what they wanted, we could live in a Lockean state of nature quite easily because we wouldn't need or want anything other. But the problem is that we have too many people, and the way of life that Hobbes describes would probably eventuate with the fights that would occur over resources, food, living areas and other stuff.
I feel like we shouldn't be treating the Lockean state of nature and the Hobbesian state of nature as necessarily equal. In the Lockean state of nature, there's still this idea that we will cooperate with others to achieve this harmony. I think Hobbes would probably say that through cooperating, we have formed a social contract with others, and then in doing so, it's actually not a state of nature. Mm. So I feel that Locke's definition and Hobbes' definition are quite different, and Hobbes probably would see Locke's as not a state of nature at all. So probably good to keep that in mind as well.
Colonel Gaddafi has secret weapons of mass destruction, so
that's the same as the other example.
We don't know where they are or how they are hidden. This is evidence of the cunning genius of the men.
Yeah,
I think that people did some things better in the past. Sue, fine. Why don't you just go back and live in a cave?
Today on the Philosopher's Zone, Laura D'Olimpio on whether young people can actually do the real thing, philosophy with a capital P.
Is maths a divine language? I'm looking forward to that. I think that'll be pretty interesting. Is it moral to fake kindness? I think that's a good question too, and looking forward to that one as well.
You might recall we visited the inaugural National Philosothon in 2011. It's come some way since Matthew Wills of Hale School first came up with the idea in 2007.
The Philosothon is an annual competition using philosophy for children, which introduces young people to philosophy. It brings together very capable students from high schools initially around really interesting philosophical and ethical questions. So we deal with topics like, do human beings have free will? Does God exist? What is the nature of the human mind? Or is it morally worse to actively kill a person than to passively allow the person to die? It's those sorts of interesting philosophical and ethical questions that are given to students prior to the event and form the stimulus for the discussions at the actual philosothon.
When the philosothon started, there seemed to be a bit of a gender imbalance where the boys seemed to do better in the philosophical inquiry than the girls. I think that this might be starting to change, but I was wondering your perspective on this.
It certainly was the case at the very outset. 6 out of the 8 years that we've run the philosothon, single-sex boys' schools have won the event. But it has changed in that 2 years ago we had Iona Presentation College won it, and then the year before that, a co-ed school, Carmel College, won it. It's interesting that in WA that it seems to be more the case than it is in other states. So, for example, in Queensland, it's been co-ed state schools that have won the event regularly. In Victoria, likewise. New South Wales, the last 2 years, North Sydney Girls High School have won it. At a national level, you've got Raffles Girls School that won it 2 years ago, and last year, North Sydney Girls High School won it that year. So certainly nationally, it's not the case. Certainly, if you look across the philosothons in various states, it's not the case. But it's interesting, in WA, as I said, 6 out of the 8 we've had have been won by single-sex boys' schools. Now, we've actively worked against that by setting up prizes for the most promising female and the most promising male philosopher. And the judges are very aware that the dynamics that go on sometimes in groups where, for all the wrong reasons, a girl might sit back and allow a male to pontificate. But certainly it's been my experience in facilitating these discussions that is genuinely or generally not the case.
So, Matthew, can you tell us what else the Philosothon has led on to?
Sure. In 2013, as part of the process of setting up the Australasian Philosothon, I visited the US and I attended the only equivalent competition that I've found anywhere in the world called the US Ethics Bowl, which is a competition around ethical issues where students sit on either side of the room and they argue for a certain position and they defend that position, and the opposite team critiques it. Professional philosophers critique their position. And at the end of the day, again, a trophy is awarded to the winning school. You know, I attended the event, I participated in that, and I thought this is a really good opportunity, perhaps for a different sort of event to the Philosothon, where we link up schools from different parts of the country using IT, using technology. We do exactly the same model, but we use technology to bring them together. Still using university lecturers to assess the event and using the same judging criteria that they use for the Ethics Bowl. So we tried it out in 2014, where we linked up our school with schools in Tennessee and California, and it went really well. And you can imagine the students were really excited about being able to delve into these ethical issues in depth and with rigour and with students on the other side of the world. And since then, we've done it over and over again with different schools all over Australia and with schools in the US. And it's just a really exciting, different way of integrating technology and philosophical and ethical discourse amongst young people.
Bringing philosophy into the high schools is a truly radical move that could prove transformative. The reason it is radical is that philosophy is a subject that asks people to think for themselves rather than recite the one correct answer to the question. So much of education today is ends-focused, with the ends being good test results and vocational skills. What is truly missing is the focus on learning for its own sake, and even more important than knowledge, is wisdom. Studying philosophy pragmatically, as set out by Matthew Lipman in his Philosophy for Children, is also radical because it assumes that young people are wise and can have knowledge about difficult, abstract concepts. Of course, the philosophical dialogue must be age-appropriate, yet teachers who work with students in a community of inquiry are always astounded by the insights that these young people can have when discussing diverse topics such as ethics, religious belief, politics, or epistemology. An additional source of pleasure is seeing how participants who regularly contribute to a community of inquiry grow in confidence and curiosity over time. Here is a space created within a classroom in which they are allowed to ask genuine questions, to which the teacher may not have the one absolute answer. And this is okay. Teachers can explore the answers together with their students, and yes, even learn from their students. Now that truly is radical. What everyone is aiming for is the best answers we have to date, with a view to self-correction. That is to say that if new information comes to light, we should be open to reflecting upon and further refining our existing answers. In a well-functioning community of inquiry, members will move from considering themselves and their own ideas as all important. They become conscious of other members' contributions and allow for the transformation and refinement of their own ideas. They eventually recognise they are not isolated thinking things, but rather part of an interdependent whole. They are members of a group of people who think and feel. It is this deep understanding that changes them. Once this understanding is internalised, then behaviour starts to change, and you see, for example, less bullying in the school playground and the rational resolution of disputes. The thinking skills philosophy promotes are essential to living a good life, and advocates of philosophy for children believe that by doing philosophy in a community of inquiry, democratic citizens will be formed who think critically, creatively, and collaboratively. Surely this is exactly what the world today needs.
Dr. Laura D'Olimpio of the University of Notre Dame, Australia, on a radical movement, you could say. Thanks also to Dr. Raymond Driehaus and his students Isabel and Braden of Perth Modern School, Stephen Millett, writer of the WA Secondary Course, and the Philosothon's Matthew Wills. Production today by Diane Dean and Martin Peralta, I'm Joe Gelidisi. More to chew over next week. See you then.